staging in case it's simple, in case that you can actually do that. And so today we want to apply this to the Gauss constraint. And so instead of taking these complicated expressions and trying to quantize them, we actually look at the gauge transformations generated by the Gauss constraint. And in the end, we will actually see that there is quite a simple expression for the Gauss constraints, which is a bit hard to guess if you see this expression, which involves the derivative of the E fields. And so at some point last week, we discussed the holonomies and how these holonomies transform under a gauge transformation. And so this was in this way that you get the multiplication from the left and right, but with different group elements in general. So where so VF is the final vertex, and VS is the source vertex of your edge. And so from this, you can conclude if you have a state, in the holonomy representation, this will transform to be now a function of the gauge transformed holonomy. And so you can rewrite that as the left action with respect to g minus 1 of your final point, and the right action, also g minus 1, at the group of the group element at your source vertex. Okay. And so this is how two Gauss constraints, so you have basically two Gauss constraints, and you have only one edge. And so they would act in this way. And we already have a measure which is invariant under left and right multiplication. That is a Haar measure. So you could group every edge the state over one edge. And so abstractly, you can write it as applying the delta function of this Gauss constraint at the source vertex and applying the delta function of the Gauss constraint at the final vertex. So these are in principle operators. And so this would be a double integral over the group. And the inverse doesn't really mention matter, because all the Haar measure is also invariant under the inverse. So it has just the left and the right action on your state. And so you can guess, since if you write it in a holonomy representation, this would be psi e of h, and if you multiply from the left and from the right, you get this thing, and you integrate over it. So you actually group a wage of over the entire group already with one integration. so what you get here is actually just a constant state. So some constant, which depends on your state, times the state, which is constant on the group, the wave function, which is constant on the group. And so this would not be very interesting. So indeed, at one edge is not sufficient to write any interesting kind of invariant observables with respect to the Gauss constraints. And since you had like gauge theory, you know that you at least need the Wilson loops. So to get something more interesting, we have actually to introduce more edges in our Hilbert space. And I mentioned that maybe a couple of times. So we need more edges. In particular, we need actually a graph, because to get something useful, these edges have to speak to each other at the vertices, because then the group, the action on the vertices generated by one Gauss constraint is always with respect to the same element. So you would have only one integration with respect to three group elements. So if you have just lots of decoupled edges, that wouldn't help, because they all transform with respect to different group elements, and you would get the same result. So we have a graph. And depending on how mathematical rigorous you want to do it, there are basically different assumptions on the precise structure of on the precise nature of these edges. So if you want to be very precise, they have to be semi-analytic. But let's just take these as an embedded graph in our manifold. And so a graph means that we have vertices, V, and we have edges, which connect between these vertices. And we can have also, in principle, two-valent vertices, which turn out not to be very informative, but you can have them. You're also allowed to have, in principle, open vertices. But you know, this kind of argument shows you that if you go to the gauge invariant phase space, this will not carry very useful information. And so we will have the structure. Do I call it something? This is a graph gamma. Okay. And the Hilbert space will be just a tensor product of all the edges included in your graph over the edge Hilbert space. So these are basically, to remind you, that is L2G. So we also, that defines you also the inner product on the Hilbert space. So you have to take the L2 inner product of every of every element here. So a state is now given by, in the holonomy representation, a state is given by psi G1, G2, G3, or I can also call it E1, E2, E3, GEN, where N is the number of edges in your Hilbert space. And so you number the edges and so on. And the inner product is basically the product of this tensor product. and that means that you integrate with the Haar measure. Applied basically to all group elements. And so this defines your Hilbert. This defines your Hilbert space for an arbitrary graph. And so if you want, again, you can always embed this Hilbert space into any other, into a Hilbert space with a finer graph by associating the constant function to additional edges. And there's a little trick of what happens if you subdivide an edge, which might come up later. Okay. And so if you have our spin, so actually it turns out also to be very convenient to use the spin network basis to solve the Gauss constraints. So if we have our spin network basis, that was for one edge, spin network basis for one edge, if you remember, these were given as the normalized matrix elements in an irreducible representation labeled by J and the matrix elements by M and N. And so now we just have a tensor product of this basis. And so we could write it in this way. And that gives us an orthonormal basis in this Hilbert space. Okay. And so here we have already seen how the Gauss constraints in principle act. If you have a source vertex, I hope, for the source vertex, it acts by like multiplication. And for the final vertex, for the target vertex, it acts by left multiplication. And so again, we can basically write what is the delta function for Gauss constraint associated to a vertex V. So to explain, now you have basically at every vertex you have a Gauss constraint, and we are actually in the continuum in principle, so you could ask what happens if I apply it, the Gauss constraint to this vertex. And nothing happens because it's not seen by your spin network. And you could also ask what happens if I apply my Gauss constraint to this vertex. It's already a slightly better question. And we will see in 2 seconds that, maybe three, that you have a trivial action. And so that the state here, that any state psi g is already invariant under this Gauss constraint. And so let me just first define this action. And then we will discuss it, because then actually, for this, I have to discuss how an edge subdivides. So we have seen that it acts by left multiplication. On these edges, which have V as a final vertex. So here you have V, and so the green edges are these ones. And so by right multiplication, so here we should call it HE. So the point is now it's the same vertex. So you have always the same group element, in fact. So you have, you know, your gauge transformation is labeled. You have one gauge transformation sitting at each point in your space. So you have one vertex. So here is the same gauge transformation. Yeah.
So you're somehow giving an orientation to each edge.
Yeah. Oh, I never mentioned that. Okay.
Well,
so here, indeed, it's oriented edges. Oriented edges. That's important.
Is there a way of orienting each edge, or is it just something that you put by hand, like arbitrarily orienting each edge?
You can arbitrarily orient each edge, and so assuming, yeah, so we might discuss it also in a second, assuming that you want to change your edge, the orientation of your edge, you actually change your spin network or your holonomy function over one edge to C prime, which is now C prime, sorry, I should write C prime of G being the same psi here, but with the inverse argument. So and that gives you the same physical information, but you need to orient the edge because it's quite important whether you take the function of G or G minus 1, G inverse. Okay. So that's actually how the Gauss constraint at one vertex acts. So I have not, you know, it's actually not only a tensor product of this action which we had, that we see a holonomy transforms under left multiplication for the final vertex and right multiplication for the source vertex. So these are these. And so if you have more edges, you act with the same edge here. And that's a Gauss, so that's how the Gauss constraint acts. And so now to come back to this question, what happens if you actually consider the action of the Gauss constraint at this edge? And so I just told you how this wave function changes if you invert an edge. So similarly, you can actually rewrite your wave function on a given graph as to the same wave function on a graph which has one edge subdivided. And so if you have here psi g, and g is this hoop element associated to this edge, so then you have GE1 here and GE2 here. And so you want to have the same physical information in your wave function, which describes this edge. So it's kind of now a wave function which depends on two group elements, because you have two group elements. But the only thing which you know about these two group elements is actually the product of these two group elements. So to write you the same state, you have to take the same wave function. And here you take the product. And our definitions of holonomies were that you take the product in this order. So that was all our conventions and so on, how to multiply things. Okay, and here you actually, so this is just the group product, and here you see that if you apply the Gauss constraint here at this vertex, and you can now basically do it at the arbitrary point of your curve. You see that this state is actually invariant, because here you would multiply by with the same group element. So on e, E1 is an incoming edge, and so this would be this case. So you multiply by left, multiplication with h minus 1, and E2 would be an outcoming edge. So that's actually this case, and you multiply with h, and so these cancel each other. So nothing happens with the Gauss constraint if they are not at the actual vertices of your graph. And so you're only left with a Gauss constraint for these vertices. And so these are the things which we are discussing, which we will discuss right now. And so what we expect is that actually, you know, we could discuss it already with the interpretation we had for our spin networks, because the spin networks over one edge. Of course, I forgot which way it was. We said that we had two angular momentum algebras associated to the final point and to the final point and to the source vertex. And so this angular momentum thing was in the representation J, or J conjugated. And this representation we got by actually looking at the left or right action on these edges. And so we have exactly the left and right action of these edges. And so what we do there is actually group averaging over the group action in these representations, which representation theoretically means that you are looking for like a trivial sub-representation. So what will happen is that we actually have to couple the angular momenta, which sit at these vertices, or actually at the edges, but at the final and starting source vertices. And so we have to couple them accordingly so that we find the trivial sub-representation in these spaces. And so this is why recoupling theory will come in, and these nice things like Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Okay. And to simplify our discussion, we look at the at the smallest non-trivial case. So we discussed the two-valent vertex, which was not particularly interesting. So we will actually discuss three-valent vertex. And so we actually take three outgoing edges. E1, E2, E3. And we take the spin network basis for these three outgoing edges and apply our formula there, so we apply our Gauss constraint to our spin network basis. And so actually, was it last lecture? Last lecture or Monday, we discussed how this left and right translation act in the spin network basis. And that was just multiplying with some representation matrices. So I write that now here immediately. So I get these sums, which come from these matrix multiplication. And so I have a group element. And so now I have all these representation matrices. T2 and 2 H. And so this is actually my operator written in this basis, in the spin network basis. So it's the same, this thing written in the spin network basis, and here is my wave function. And I think, you sum over the p's, so you replace actually p here. And so what you need to know is basically just this product of three group elements. And so it's something which only depends on these coefficients. And so it actually happens to be defined. It's equal to these so-called Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Actually, these are not exactly the Clebsch-Gordans, but they have very confusing names. So they are called, sometimes they are called the 3J n-symbols or the Wigner 3J symbols. Maybe we call them. And so they're well known from angular momentum coupling. And so the only annoying thing is that everything comes with lots of phases. So here it actually is that you have a funny sign, dimension factor, and then now going to the bracket notion for your angular momentum. This is, in principle, basically the coupling of two angular momenta, J1 and J2, with magnetic indices M1 and M2. Angular momentum J3 and so very annoyingly you also have a minus M3 here.
The way you have addition, the first 3J symbol have P.
Yeah, indeed.
P1.
Thanks. So this will be just a prefactor, and you sum over this 3J symbol times this element. And so you see here that this inner product, this 3JM symbol, comes from coupling two angular momenta to a third one. And so what you actually do in this case, you can consider is that this is kind of by dualizing, and the dualizing is actually minus M3. This is equivalent of coupling three angular momenta. To the trivial representation, to a trivial to the trivial representation, and for three angular momenta, it happens that this is unique, so it's either not possible, or there's only one-dimensional subspace, so that you can do that. So it really means Vj1 times, you take, the tensor product of these two, of these three representations, and you decompose it into irreducible representation. And so there is, if you are lucky, there is one one subspace, one-dimensional subspace, which carries the trivial representation to 4j equal to 0. And so these coefficients actually extract the subspace out of this tensor product. So that means if we consider basically indeed the sum, we ignore this, we ignore for this coefficient because it's just a prefactor. So this defines me a certain state. Which I can call GE. And so the only thing left over are these MEs. So I had these. So I have still these open edges, M1, M2, M3. But I have no indices left at the vertex because I contracted everything. And so indeed, because we did here a group, we did a group averaging here, this state is invariant on the right and left under the action of the Gauss constraint at this vertex. So if I now apply left multiplication, it will be invariant under this, and you find the same state. And it happens also to be normalized. And so this happens because actually these three JM symbols are normalized. In this way, so if you take the sum G1, we have not done much. It's again just a coupling of of the three vertices meeting at the vertex via to a trivial representation, and this happens via a so-called intertwiner. And so intertwiner is unfortunately a bit used for everything. So you could call these tensors, so they're tensors in and you can call it an intertwiner. And so you actually have these intertwiners at three valent vertices. And so at three valent vertices, there's only one intertwiner. And it comes because it's an intertwiner. It's a tensor which acts on these things, on these three representation spaces. And it maps to V0. And so it maps in an intertwining way in the sense that it would commute with a group action. However, V0 has a trivial group action, so it really means that it's invariant under this group action here. So this you can call it intertwiner. So if you have higher valent vertices, you can have more intertwiners. But the easiest thing to get these more intertwiners is to actually take a higher valent vertex and kind of virtually subdivide it into three valent vertices. And so you see that in this case, what happens is that your virtual intertwiner label, so that is basically the number of intertwiners is basically given by the number of independent tensors which are invariant under this group action. And you could split this vertex, and you can split it into two ways, but the different ways of splitting actually just define you different ways of recoupling your angular momentum, and so there's also recoupling identities and recoupling bases and entire books. You can read about it. But here you see that the number of intertwiners is basically given by the number of representation labels you can write at this virtual edge, and the number of representation labels is determined by the so-called coupling conditions. So let me see at which point I actually discuss these. Later. But maybe I should do it here. So you can ask when does this trivial representation exist in the representation space of three edges? And so I guess you have heard it. And you see it from this picture. You will have a hard time finding a trivial representation if G3 is too short. And so what you actually find is the triangle inequalities for these as a coupling condition. And so you have the sum of two edges or of the spins associated to two edges should be equal or greater than the third edge. And so this confirms our finding of an interpretation of the length spectrum, which was roughly proportional to J, very roughly. And so there's another coupling condition, which is not so important. And this is this should be a natural number. If I remember correctly, it's not allowed to be a half integer. If I remember correctly. OK, and so indeed, to find the number of intertwiners here, you would have to see how many j's are here which satisfy the triangle inequality at this vertex and at this vertex. OK, and so what the only thing what we need else, so we discussed one three-valent vertex. And so all edges were outgoing. Unfortunately, you cannot have only vertices with outgoing edges. And so sometimes you have also ingoing edges. And this will be just a slight variation of this thing. So let's have, and I just give you the result. So it's lots of faces and so on. So there's a situation that you have. Two edges incoming. That's what we need at some point. E1, E2 is incoming, and E3 is outgoing. And so in this case, you have some annoying minus signs. And for the outgoing edges, we busy summed over the last index. So for the ingoing edges, we will sum over the first index. And so here you sum over all the indices which are attached to this vertex, and the free indices are for the outer vertices, T2, Q2, and 2. Okay, and so you can guess what happens in all the other cases. So you actually have to, if you sum over the first index, you have a minus sign here. And you have to include the sign. And this comes all from this dualization or contragradient representation. As you can imagine, the minus sign are real joy. And so we just introduced triangles. Ah, yeah. So we have these three valent vertices. So let's discuss more this interpretation. We have the three valent vertices, and they were oriented in some way, for instance, outgoing. And at some point, we indeed discussed the length variables, and we discussed this triangle inequality. But we actually haven't seen a triangle. But indeed, we say that the length variables are to the edges, which are dual to the spin to these graph edges. And so I could, of course, draw them completely arbitrary in this way. People like to connect them. And so indeed, this is the right interpretation, which, you know, comes from the triangle inequality. And so now you really have a triangle and so in a sense it exists, corresponds to having a gauge invariant coupling between these three edges. And so it tells nicely, it's very nice that you see that we matched the geometry one to one. So a triangle is indeed completely specified by the three edge lengths. And so what we found here is just a unique solution to the Gauss constraint for a three valent vertex. And so only for four valent vertices, we would have, you know, you could draw a quadrangle, something like this. But this is actually not uniquely defined by its edge lengths. And so to define it uniquely, you need to specify one more data. And this would be like either specifying this diagonal or this diagonal, which actually means that you have to go to a triangulation. So the point of about triangulations is that the geometry is uniquely specified. As a piecewise linear flat geometry is uniquely specified by the edge length. And so this edge length is given by the J values. And you have seen that the spectrum was not exactly J, but sometimes was the square root of J, J plus 1. And indeed, there's a bit of discussion about ordering the length operator or adding or subtracting a plus 1/2 and so on. So let's not, that can all be summarized into quantum corrections. And let's not be too concerned about this at this moment. But you see you have a triangle. And as a last remark, and for this triangle, I told you Gauss constraint, if we really look into this Gauss constraint, it used to be in the continuum like d epsilon plus epsilon a epsilon or something. So it was kind of a complicated expression. However, we said we should just look at the gauge transformations generated by the Gauss constraint. And so this was a kind of something which we could deal with. And so knowing this gauge transformation, we can ask the other way around and take the define the Gauss constraint by the infinitesimal derivative of the gauge action. And so indeed, if we do that for this vertex, then we know that the Gauss constraint here leads to right multiplication or right translation for all these edges. And so if you take the derivative of our right translation, we get the left invariant derivative. And that was defined to be the fluxes. So modulo some constants, which I ignore, it's really that the Gauss constraint, which indeed had three components, is given as a sum of these three fluxes. And so you either are in this triangle picture, which tells you you have a triangle inequality, or you're in the dual picture. And then it just tells you, OK, that's now you know why it's called fluxes. The sum of the fluxes is zero. So that's indeed the Gauss constraint. And so here you see basically in this dual picture the interpretation of this. And so this is indeed the quantization of the Gauss constraint. And we can quantize it at the vertices. And basically, you could do the same for, you could try something similar for these edges. And there would be just two fluxes here. But then the orientation is such that for these kind of states, you would always get zero. For these kinds of states, you would get zero. OK. And so this gives you lots of interpretation. And actually, so these are the fluxes. Alternatively, you can actually understand the fluxes. So they, so I had some condition for the orientation. And if you apply it for the orientation of the dual edges, so it's either this way or the other way around. But if you apply it, the main point is that it's cyclic. And so the other interpretation is that these fluxes give you indeed the edge vector. And again, you have in the frame, which is attached to the triangle. And so indeed, you see that this just holds. This has to hold for the triangle to be closed. It just means that E3 is given the third edge vector, is given as a linear combination of the other two to form a triangle. And so this tells you that you can indeed draw this as a triangle, actually. And why is this a frame? So we introduce these fluxes and so on, indeed, as co-triads and triads in the interpretation of frames. And the gauge transformations, which we did all the time, we're just changing the frame. And so here, indeed, this gauge transformation means that you change the frame. And so you change, actually, the components with respect to this changing. I mean, the vector is not changed. But the expression of E in this changing frame, of course, changes with the frame. And so since the gauge transformations are at the vertices, you can conclude that the frames also sit at the vertices, and you change these frames. And so going to another vertex, actually, you make a frame transformation, or you transport your frame from here to there. OK. So much for the interpretation. So I have 5 minutes left. And this is the triangles. And so given 4 triangles, we can build a tetrahedron. And so a tetrahedron looks like this. And so very confusingly, I mean, if you look on top of this tetrahedron, it looks like this. And so now you can draw the dual to this tetrahedron. So let's say this is really the geometric tetrahedron of with 4 triangles. And so to draw the dual, you have to put a vertex on every triangle. And then you have to connect these vertices with each other. And it gets a bit complicated at some point. And so here you have this. And it goes there. And here you have this tetrahedron. And actually, you know, the mathematician says everything outside is basically equal to the fourth face, to this one below. So you can also draw the dual in this 2D picture. And so then you would do this. And so if you rearrange this funny thing, then you get actually the same picture as you started with. So it's actually tetrahedron is kind of self-dual in this self-2D dual, actually, in that the graph, the connectivity of the graph for the dual and the triangulation is actually the same. And so we will have this tetrahedron. And so I orient the edges in this way. So we have one one vertex where all edges are outgoing, and then the others, we have always two incoming edges, and one outgoing. So that's the reason why I introduced these gauge invariant states, this combination of edges. And then you can name your edges, J3, J4. And so in principle, you would know how to write your spin network for this graph and your gauge invariant spin network, actually. Because we have all ingredients there. And so you get a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, or the 3J ensemble for every vertex. And you have four vertices. We get four of these. And now you are left with, so you contract, you know, all edges here. So there are no magnetic indices left. And the only thing what is left is are the representation labels. So let's call this function. So it's a state. It depends on six representation labels, six spins. And so if we apply all these rules which we had there on the right-hand side of taking 3JM symbols and so on, we sum over one set of magnetic indices, another set of magnetic indices. So for each edge, there are two. And so actually, for each edge, we get a minus sign because each edge is outgoing somewhere or incoming somewhere, naturally. And then we have three of these. So this is, you can see that there's one vertex with J1, J2, J3, and this is where all are outgoing. And then you have the other ones where two are incoming and one is outgoing. And so I save a bit of writing here. And so these are all the Clebsch-Gordans. And then, as you can get, you have actually the basic states, a tensor product of these. And so this is a tetrahedron state, the state on a tetrahedron, the gauge invariant state on a tetrahedron. And it will be quite important and will be almost a solution, will basically provide us via a simple trick in the end, which we will derive, of course, with lots of pain. It will provide us actually also with a solution to the Gauss constraints. This trick is to replace, this will be replaced by just a Kronecker delta. And this comes from setting all the group elements here equal to one. And indeed, if you set all group elements equal to one, that gives you a flat connection. And so we will discuss that in the next lecture. And this will actually solve our theory for 3D quantum gravity for the sphere, at least. And then if you contract this, this symbol has also a name. And modulo dimension, this will be the 6J symbol, which you know, this actually just comes from a recoupling of three angular momenta, and we will discuss this. And if there's time in the final lecture, I might tell you about the path integral, and then the 6J symbol is a very complicated way, as we will see, of expressing the delta function in your group holonomies. Okay. Yeah, it's in principle possible, but so it's described by, I think, Thomas Thiemann. But the problem is, so in this case, I don't know if other people have talked about it, and he uses a machinery which is called infinite tensor product expansion or something. So it's something you could do, but you need to always deal with the possibility of having infinite edges at once, not only under refinement. So here, with a compact space, you can always assume that the graphs are finite, and so you could, you know, basically do the same or not care that you have infinite many edges. But if you want to really do it mathematically correct, you have to go through a bit of mathematics to make it all well defined.
What's the difficulty to describe, like Minkowski?
Minkowski space? I mean, there's a difficulty of having semi-classical states and so on, and solving the Hamiltonian constraints. But the a priori, even before this, there's just a difficulty, for instance, so in defining our inner product, we always used that we had finite sums or finite expressions, so it was a finite product. So if you want to do Minkowski space, then you have to think, or something like Minkowski space, so you want to do actually asymptotically flat, then you have first a difficulty, you have to specify your boundary conditions, which means, and so this means that your matrix is decreasing, and you have to implement them into the quantum theory, which is the first difficulty. And then you have to make sense out of defining your product, defining your inner product as a tensor product over infinitely many factors. And okay, and there's a mathematical machinery for this, but it's not completely trivial if you want to be mathematically precise. And so these are, you know. But then to really describe Minkowski space, you have to actually solve the constraints and find something. I mean, and 2 plus 1, this is possible. I think you could do that. But I don't think anybody has done it which is really, mathematically rigorous.
One question. So you said that we're going to find what happens in the case where the manifold is a sphere, right?
Uh-huh.
But here we have talked only about graphs embedded in some manifold. So where does the topology of the manifold come into play?
This we fixed at the outset, at the very beginning.
Right.
Our canonical analysis. So there are different attitudes to this. So you could, actually say, so some people say, because you have all these graphs, okay, it actually, I mean, in this case, you cannot, from a given graph in general, you cannot really conclude about the topology of your manifold, especially if your manifold can have holes or something, or whatever, you know, functions. But in principle, in this case, you actually would allow all graphs which you can embed in your manifold. And so then you need to reconstruct from this knowledge somehow your manifold. And the other approach is always to work with some finite kind of discretization, or to say, to always work with graphs which allow you to at least, you know, from kind of simplicial homology to conclude what the actual topology of your manifold is. So you choose a graph which is fine enough to be able to reconstruct the topology, and you see, and you make this definition from the outset. And so this is very safe to do in 2+1.
Okay.
Okay.